Hello, and welcome to On Science. I'm science desk intern Megan Boss. This week, we'll take a look at how we humans are changing the world around us. We'll hear about genetically modified canola popping up along the roadside, an attempt to save oysters in Maryland, and the 35th anniversary of the phrase global warming. But first, our series, The Human Edge, has been exploring how evolution made us the dominant species on the planet. This week, we'll take a look at the human brain. Depending on the way you look at it, our brains are either evolutionary masterpieces or 3 pounds of inefficient jelly. NPR's John Hamilton discovered that both descriptions are true.
Lots of people use superlatives to describe the human brain. Then there are scientists like David Linden at Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore.
Although the things it can do are very wonderful and impressive, its design is very poor engineering in many respects.
Linden says there's a simple explanation: evolution.
In evolution, you never build something new if you can adapt something you've already got. It's the ultimate tinkerer and the ultimate cheapskate.
So our brain has been put together with parts from jellyfish and lizards and mice. Linden says these parts may have been okay for their original owners, but they aren't so great for us. Take brain cells.
They are slow. They are inefficient. They leak signals to their neighbors. And consequently, if you want to build clever human us with these very suboptimal parts, the only way to do it is to build a brain that is simply enormous and massively interconnected.
And it's still slow. Linden says getting a simple message from our feet to our brain can take a long time.
For example, if there were a giant with her head in Baltimore and her toe off the coast of South Africa, and she was bit by a great white shark on the toe on Monday, she wouldn't feel it until Wednesday, and she wouldn't jerk her toe until Saturday.
Why the lag? Linden says it's because we're still using a communication system developed 600 million years ago by jellyfish. They were the first animal to have any sort of nervous system.
Jellyfish.
I'm at the National Zoo with Chet Sherwood, who studies brain evolution at the George Washington University. Sherwood says jellyfish don't have a brain.
Jellyfish have a nervous system, but it would be best described as a nerve net.
A loose network of nerves that carries simple messages like start eating when something gets caught in the jelly's tentacles. Jellyfish don't exactly live life in the fast lane, so the nerve messages can travel slowly. The ones on a telephone wire move a million times faster. But Sherwood says once evolution came up with a messaging system, it kept using it.
The nerves and the manner in which signals are sent is similar to what we have ourselves.
David Linden says our brains are also limited by design features we share with lizards. Evolution's tinkering gave them the brain they needed to hunt and survive in a tough world. And Linden says our brains still have that ancient wiring.
If I throw a baseball at you, you're going to reflexively duck your head, and there's nothing you can do to override that with your conscious mind. It is hardwired, and you're going to do it, and your ancient subconscious lizard-like visual system is doing that task.
Unfortunately, that sort of fight-or-flight response isn't great for most social interactions. At the zoo, Chet Sherwood and I see a young primate in a T-shirt talking to an iguana on the other side of the glass. The iguana does not look happy.
He's doing a head gesture. Looks like he's trying to communicate something to one of these zoo guests.
It looks a little aggressive.
It does.
A lizard brain is about survival. It controls heart rate and breathing. It processes information from the eyes and ears and mouth. When mammals like mice came along, the lizard brain didn't go away. Linden says it became the brain stem, which is perched on top of the spine. Then evolution slapped more brain on top of that.
It's like adding scoops to an ice cream cone. So if you imagine the lizard brain as a single scoop ice cream cone, the way you make a mouse brain out of a lizard brain isn't to throw the cone in the first scoop away and start over and make a banana split. Rather, it's to put a second scoop on top of the first scoop.
That second scoop helped give mammals more memory and a wider range of emotions. You can see that at the zoo in the naked mole rats. Chet Sherwood and I watch them scamper through a labyrinth of plastic tubes.
It's got a brain that has a neocortex, which is the most expanded part of the forebrain, which is shared by all mammals.
The neocortex allows naked mole rats to do things a lizard can't, like using experiences to anticipate danger instead of just responding to it. At a zoo, you can cover millions of years of evolution in a few steps. That's what Chet Sherwood and I do when we walk from the mole rats to the gorillas, where a mother is watching over her baby.
They're sitting closely together. The mother's looking out at the crowd.
Sherwood says if a brain is like an ice cream cone, apes got the third scoop. It's the part that allows these gorillas to reason and live much more complicated lives.
In these brains, you can find all of the very same parts that you would see in a human brain.
But there's a big difference. The brain of an adult human is about 3 times the size of a gorilla brain. Much of the size difference appears after birth. The human brain continues to grow rapidly for the first 5 years. David Linden says it takes 20 years before all the circuits are laid out and connected up.
A miracle happens. You have enough neurons in this cortical circuit, massively interconnected, and somehow what emerges from that are these amazing human traits, the ability for me to know what you are thinking based on social cues that you give me, other forms of observational learning and high-level cognition.
In one sense, we've had to pay a heavy cost for our big, inefficient brains. Childbirth is difficult, childhood is long. Our brains consume 20% of the calories we eat. But Linden says these adaptations turn out to have some surprising payoffs, like romantic love.
If our neurons weren't such lousy processors and we didn't need 100 billion of them massively interconnected in order to make a clever brain out of such lousy parts, then we wouldn't have such a long childhood while that brain grew up and matured after birth, and it wouldn't drive the dominant human mating system. We wouldn't have love.
An integral part of our 3 pounds of inefficient jelly. John Hamilton, NPR News.
Evolution is a slow process. So instead of waiting for Mother Nature, sometimes we take things into our own hands. Farmers have selected and bred their best plants for thousands of years. Now scientists can directly modify the genes and crops that we want to grow. And the number of farmers growing bioengineered crops is increasing. So it's not all that surprising that some of these plants are showing up beyond the fields they were planted in. NPR's Jeff Prumfiel reports.
This story begins in a parking lot in Cavalier, North Dakota. Cindy Sagers, an ecologist from the University of Arkansas, was visiting to study weeds, but there were none to be found.
Since we couldn't find any weeds, we were sitting in the car enjoying a soda at the only grocery store in Cavalier County. We looked through the windshield and there were these beautiful yellow flowers blooming.
Anyone who's been to the state would recognize this plant as canola. Over 1 million acres of canola are grown in North Dakota, and roughly 90% are varieties that have been genetically modified to resist herbicides. This raised an interesting question. Were the plants growing in the parking lot conventional varieties or GM strains? Sagers and her graduate student, Meredith Schaefer, decided to find out.
So we walk over, grab one of the plants out, and to be sure, you know, we had these strips that we could test for the resistance.
Kind of like a pregnancy test. 1 stripe, normal canola. 2 stripes, GM canola. Sure enough, 2 stripes.
Almost immediately, we headed west on the highway and just began sampling every 5 miles.
1 year and 3,000 miles later, the group has clear evidence that GM canola is growing fertile across North Dakota. 86% of plants sampled were genetically altered versions. It sounded potentially alarming, so to find out the implications, I called possibly the only place in the world with more GM canola than North Dakota.
you looked outside my window, you would see mostly a field of yellow flowering canola. It's absolutely beautiful at this time of year.
Linda Hall studies environmental biosafety at the University of Alberta in Canada. Hall knows a lot about GM canola. It was first introduced to Canada about a decade ago, and it's now grown extensively across millions of acres of land. It's actually common to find it on roadsides there.
Canola is a very small seeded crop. Those seeds are easily lost out of trucks along roadsides, and they form little populations along the roadsides. Very common to see them all through where canola is grown.
These colonies are easy to find, but they haven't spread much beyond the roads. That's because all canola, even GM varieties, can't compete in the wild.
It's pretty spoiled. It's used to growing in well-fertilized, clean seed beds without competition. So it does not do well if it is having to compete with other plants.
Canadian researchers initially worried that GM canola might become a weed in farmers' fields or outcompete native plants. But Hall says there's no evidence that this is happening. Cindy Sagers says that GM canola isn't going to take over North Dakota either.
Whether these canolas are going to climb up and bury standing forest, I don't think that's going to happen.
But Sagers says her work highlights an important issue. Future varieties of genetically modified crops will escape into the environment. Studying North Dakota's canola should teach researchers exactly how that spreading occurs and what the potential impacts could be. Jeff Brumfield, NPR News.
Now let's talk about a different kind of harvest. Humans have harvested oysters at the Chesapeake Bay in Maryland and Virginia for more than a century. But we've overdone it, and now the native oysters are barely hanging on. The state of Maryland wants to help the oyster population bounce back by creating sanctuaries where harvesting will be banned. Sabri Benashur from WAMU visited a sanctuary to find out more.
Under the murky water of the Severn River in Maryland, just off the Chesapeake Bay, divers are searching the bottom. They report back over an intercom.
It's not too bad, but it's the Severn.
They're looking for the oysters they planted 5 years ago. The water is cloudy, and they spend a few minutes looking around. There was a time when this water was crystal clear, and when you didn't have to search for oysters, you could practically trip over them. In fact, early explorers considered them a navigation hazard. When he sailed the bay in 1607, John Smith wrote that the reefs were so high they stuck out of the water. But by 1920, three-quarters of the bay's reefs had been wrenched from the water and harvested for meat. Old photos show piles of shells hundreds of feet high. Even so, there used to be a few places where oysters still thrived, even 40 years ago. Mutt Merritt is a biologist. His lab at Horn Point hatched the oysters the divers are looking for now.
When I was a kid, oyster reefs were everywhere. Back in 72 or so, the minute I put my head underwater, I was in about 30 feet of water, I could see oysters on the bottom. It's just very different out there now.
Things got really bad when diseases carried by ships from abroad started to wipe them out. Runoff from farms and cities buried the survivors in sediment. Pollution just made things worse. Now the population is just a small fraction of what it used to be. Back on the bottom of the river, the divers have found something.
All right, we got them.
They come up to the surface with volleyball-sized clusters of oysters. Stephanie Westbay is a fisheries scientist with the Chesapeake Bay Foundation.
You can see now they've grown into these really big, healthy clumps of oysters. A few dead oysters, but virtually all of them are alive.
And a lot of other creatures came up with the bits of reef. They slither out from the nooks and crevices in between the shells.
And if you look carefully on the deck here, you can see all kinds of worms and mud crabs and some little shrimp kicking around and that kind of thing.
By offering a place to live and hide to those creatures, the reef creates food for bigger creatures.
Striped bass, blue crabs, a variety of fish that feed on them.
Bruce Goldbrow directs the fisheries program with the Chesapeake Bay Foundation.
So you're actually fueling the food web, because then you get a lot more of those fish that we actually catch and have economic value for us.
He says in other sanctuaries, the reefs have attracted fish like black sea bass, which haven't been seen in the bay for decades. The mollusks are also little water treatment plants, filtering the water and keeping it clear so underwater plants can grow.
So that's why the reef community itself is not just about having a pile of oysters, but it's about restoring the functioning of the whole ecosystem.
Maryland's Department of Natural Resources will finalize its new sanctuaries in September. The idea is to fill them with oysters and then leave them alone. A lot is riding on the plant. Watermen are skeptical and worried this will make it harder to make a living. But with all of the oysters' problems, scientists say the sanctuaries are the last best hope these creatures have. For NPR News, I'm Sabri Benishore.
Human activity has not only affected the land we stand on and the water we swim in, but also the skies above us. The Earth has been getting warmer for decades. But ironically, the term global warming was first used when the Earth's temperature was relatively stable. NPR's Guy Raz marked the 35th anniversary of the term by speaking with two climate scientists, including the one who coined the phrase.
A few days ago, Andreas Munchau, a professor at the University of Delaware, got a call from some colleagues in Canada. Munchau had been looking at a specific glacier in Greenland for years. It's called the Petermann Glacier. And on Thursday, he found out that a massive chunk of it broke off to form an ice island.
This ice island is about the size four times Manhattan.
That's 92 square miles, the largest iceberg to form in the Arctic since 1962. And over the next 3 years, that ice island will melt away into the ocean, 18 cubic kilometers of water.
Which is the equivalent of kind of like about 120 days worth of what people in the U.S. use out of their tap water for showering and drinking and sprinkling their lawns.
Now, these things happen. Icebergs naturally break off into the Arctic. It's just that they're happening with greater frequency today. And Andreas Munchau doesn't know just yet if this icebreak has anything to do with climate change, but you only have to look at satellite pictures of Greenland to see that more of it is melting away faster than at any other time in recorded history. Now, it just so happens that 35 years ago, on this day, August 8th, a then-obscure geochemist at Columbia University named Wallace Broker published a journal article that, for the first time, used the term global warming. And, as you might expect, it caused a sensation.
I don't think people paid all that much attention to it, actually.
Okay, not quite a sensation. The article in question in the journal Science passed with barely a mention. It was called "Are We on the Brink of a Pronounced Global Warming?" Broker was arguing that the Earth was about to get a whole lot hotter, and he was trying to crack a scientific puzzle. Humans were pouring more and more carbon into the atmosphere from their cars and factories, and it meant that the Earth should have been getting warmer. But at that point, it wasn't.
And it puzzled me, and so I was looking for a reason, and I came upon a record, a new record from the Greenland Ice Core, which suggested that there were fluctuations, and the latest one was a cooling. So I proposed that perhaps the cooling had been balancing out the CO2 warming, you know, natural cooling.
In other words, the cooling was masking the fact that there should have been a warming based on, I guess, science, on physics, that more CO2 in the atmosphere should have been heating the Earth up.
Exactly. And these cycles that were seen in the ice core from Greenland, one of them had an 80-year period. So the 40 years of plateau, no warming, corresponded to half of the, 80-year cycle. And so I proposed in the article that if that were the case, then the situation should turn around in short order, and we should see a natural warming which would join forces with a CO2 warming.
In other words, when that natural cooling cycle ended, then there would be a natural heating cycle, but that would join forces with the artificial elements, the carbon that humans were putting into the atmosphere, and that would create a kind of a super warming?
Yes, and that's what I proposed. And that article was published, of course, in 1975. And lo and behold, in 1976, the temperature started to rise, and it's been rising more or less ever since.
Now, your predictions turned out, obviously, to be correct, accurate. This July was the warmest on record in the U.S. Are you surprised that it was so accurate?
Well, it was dumb luck, because it turns out that the record in Greenland was a very unusual record. And as we, over the years, got more and more records, the cycles that showed up so strongly in this northern Greenland ice core didn't show up anywhere else. So one might say that my prediction was based on, in a sense, nonsense. But on the other hand, it turned out to be correct. So maybe there's something going on in my head that I don't understand.
That's Wallace Broker. He's a professor of geochemistry at Columbia University and the man who coined the phrase global warming 35 years ago today. Wallace Broker, thank you so much.
Well, I'm pleased to be here.
That's it for this week's edition of On Science. For more science news, check out our website at npr.org/science. I'm Megan Voss. Thanks for listening.